behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hi, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Scott Benjamin.
And I am Ben Bolin.
And today we have another listener suggestion, and I think it is an outstanding suggestion.
You know what? Yes, it is, Scott. Literally, it stands out. We were both pretty interested in this when we heard from this guy.
Yeah, that's right. This one comes from Aaron S., and Aaron wrote in via email and says, first of all, congratulations on your 600 episodes.
Thank you.
It's been a great podcast to listen to and has brought many hours of entertainment and education for me.
Not bad. Yeah, we have our ups and downs.
That's right. Okay, so he goes on to say, I thought a great episode suggestion would be the history of the Bathurst 1000 race and track. It's one of the biggest events in the V8 Supercar Series, and with it only about a month away, I thought it would be the perfect time to do an episode on it. Thanks for reading my email and keep up the amazing work you guys do. Oh, that's very nice.
Wow, thank you, Aaron.
Very complimentary, Aaron. Yeah. I appreciate it. And the good news is this episode is going to air right before the 2014 edition of the Bathurst 1000.
Ah, how appropriate, or if we're being fancy, apropos. Scott, where do you want to start with this? Because this race has some history.
Yeah, long history.
Not under the same name, but a lot of history.
Well, the track itself opened way back in 1938, and it's not called the Bathurst Track or anything like that. It's in Bathurst, but it is actually the Mount Panorama Circuit in Bathurst, New South Wales, Australia.
Mm-hmm.
We won't say that whole name throughout the entire podcast, but the Bathurst Circuit, the Mount Panorama Circuit, maybe we'll call it that. The Bathurst 1000, which is currently called the Super Cheap Auto Bathurst 1000,
right,
is a 1,000-kilometer race, so that's about 620 miles, and the track is sometimes called the Mountain because it's got these long uphill and downhill straights. It's a very unusual track. You want to go into the stats, I guess?
Yeah, sure. It's a little under 4 miles or 6.2 kilometers, and it has 23 turns, which I think is interesting here because, you know, as a driver, you have to learn the circuit intimately. So you have to know which turns you can accelerate toward, which turns you need to be very careful around. And this thing has some straightaways too, right, Scott?
Yeah, some long, long straights. Now, the Conrad Straight is probably the one that most people are familiar with or have heard of. And I believe it was named, and I'm going to just have to search the depths of my memory here, Ben, because I didn't write it down, but I believe it was named the Conrad Straight back in 1939 when someone broke a connecting rod on that straight in a Grand Prix race or something like that. And it was named for that event, I guess. And most of these turns will have names, of individuals who, have either crashed or, there was some kind of event that happened on that turn. And that's how a lot of racetracks end up with the names that they give these turns. They're not always named right from the get-go, Murray's Corner or whatever it is.
Right. That's kind of uncool to Murray.
Yeah.
If he started in the race.
Well, true.
There's one of the notorious turns of this circuit is known as Hell Corner, and it is called Hell Corner, not in some ironic way or sarcastic way, the way you would call a big person Little John or something. It's called Hell Corner because it's a 90-degree left-hander.
Yeah, it's a difficult one to make, and that's not the only 90-degree turn.
Right.
On this course. Now, one thing I want to mention here, and I've looked this up, and again, I'm searching through my notes here. I'm not going to find it, but I'm going to just wing it again.
Wing it.
All right. I believe that I know this, Ben. They added three turns to this track not long ago. I want to say it was like in the mid-1980s.
Okay.
The Conrad Straight was even longer than it is now, and they had to add a series of three pretty fast turns, but series of three turns that would scrub off enough speed so that when they do make this extreme left-hand turn, they wouldn't be at full speed. It was a very dangerous part of the track for a long, long time, and this was kind of the solution. I think a driver had perished on that corner the year before. He was a touring car driver of some sort. I'll have to find the note. I'm sure I'll run across it as we go through here, but it was created in response to that event happening, and that's the case with a lot of these things. We've seen that before where they break up long straights because the speeds just get too fast. The machines become too quick.
Right. And that's something that we found in several other circuit races like this. Now, here's what's interesting. When we talk about the current track, and you said the current track dates back to the 30s, the race ultimately dates back to 1960 when it was called the Armstrong 500, and it was not at Mount Panorama.
No, that's right. It was being held at another place. It was being held in Victoria, right? It was held at Phillips Island,
mm-hmm.
and this was a completely different race altogether. I mean, it'll keep the namesake, right? Because
sure.
it carried over, as we'll find out, because I've got kind of the rundown of the entire race sponsorship all the way through present day. And we can, if we step through this, it gives us a good picture of the history of the track, and we can break off into side discussions along the way if you'd like.
Perfect. That sounds like our chronology.
I'll kind of toss some extra things in here as well. Oh, you know what? I'm taking a look at my notes here now, and I do have some information on that.
Oh, you found it?
Yeah, on the turn.
Yeah.
Now, the three turns are called the Chase,
mm-hmm.
and they were added in 1987 in preparation for the World Touring Car Championship that was to be held. Now, the three turns, of course, I mentioned they were to slow down, you know, the fast Conrad Straight.
Right.
Because it's a 90-degree turn called Murray's Corner. I was right with the corner name. I forgot about that.
But 23rd and final turn.
Yeah, yeah. So it's a, you know, these three turns were added not that long ago, 1987. So, you know, they don't go back quite as far as the 1938 original 20-turn course.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So let's move on with this. So you mentioned that it was the Armstrong 500. Now, this is unusual, Ben. This is a 500-mile race, and that's going to be important in just a minute because we're going to switch over.
Or 800 kilometers.
Kind of a strange twist here on this whole thing. It's strange. All right, so from 1960 to 1962, that's three races, the race was called the Armstrong 500, and it was, again, a 500-mile race held at Phillips Island in Victoria. And so that's about, what, 800 kilometers, you said, right?
Yeah, it's also, it's got a bit of a different aim here. It's kind of a showcase for production cars. They want to see which one has the best combination of speed, performance, reliability, and it's a promotional tool.
Now, does this sound like anything to you? This is maybe a quick first side conversation. This sounds an awful lot like NASCAR, doesn't it?
Yeah, it sure does.
It really does. Now, these are four-door sedans, so mm-hmm. it's a little different. I mean, it's not, you know, quite the good old boys back in the hills that, you know, have been running whiskey their whole life or anything like that. These guys are drivers that are in, you know, the modern sedan vehicles, you know, the four-door cars, the saloon cars, which we call
sure.
sedans.
Yeah.
And they're just competing for almost like, it's almost like a manufacturer series, really. You know, they're there to show off their latest and greatest product.
Right. Like, almost like an exhibition game in baseball. However, there is one important difference between Armstrong 500 and NASCAR, Scott, and that's that there is an Armstrong company that manufactures shock absorbers and other products. And so this is a big promotional tool for them.
Yeah, as will be the case throughout the whole history of the thing. The sponsorship of the race, the main sponsor gets their name up front, you know, front and center on the name of the race itself.
Right. Now, NASCAR has sponsors for teams, but, you know, NASCAR itself does not manufacture shock absorbers.
That's right. But they will have main sponsors for events. So it'll be the Tide 500 that's run, you know, wherever. I don't know the names of any of these races. I'm sorry. I should, but I don't.
That's just an example.
Example. Yeah, you're right. So just a quick side note here. The first race was won by a guy named Frank Code and John Roxborough in a Vauxhall Cresta, which was the only Vauxhall in a field of 45 cars. Now, take a look back at what a Vauxhall Cresta looks like, and you'll think, there's no way that car was racing in 1960.
Much less winning. But here's part of the reason the Vauxhall could win. I know we're just sidebars on sidebars here, because entry in the Armstrong 500 was limited to unmodified production cars.
Oh, okay. So that makes sense then. I mean, there's a possibility for anybody really to step in and win this thing with you know, driver talent, the correct setup in the vehicle. You know, we could go on all day about it. You know,
yeah. Anyway, 63, they move.
Yeah. They moved to the Mount Panorama track and, at the Bathurst, you know, New South Wales location. And the reason was because after only 3 years, the surface on the Phillips Island track had broken up so badly that it was completely unsafe for racing.
Yep. And they kept the Armstrong 500 name there because it was becoming a recognizable brand, and the rules explicitly state the same cars in the race have to be identical to the cars that, you know, the average Australian customer could buy in a showroom.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And cars like, you know, the Ford Cortina 500 was running, and you know, just Mini Coopers were some of the other vehicles that were in this thing. It was a strange mix of vehicles, really.
No. Yeah, it was
just a weird mix. I don't know, to think about all these cars on the track now, but if you look back at, you know, vintage photographs of racing during that time, those are the cars you're going to see. And I guess that, you know, 50 years from now, people are going to look back at the cars that are running now and say, well, that's a strange mix that's on the track. But that's just the way it is. It's always going to be that way,
right? But Scott, I would say here it's different and it's a bit strange in comparison to other races just because we have cars that are designed for wildly different uses and applications, right? And this leads to a certain, I don't know if I would say inequality, but there's such a spread of stats here that in 67, they have to say a mandated number of pit stops.
Yeah, okay. So they start changing the rules up because things have to change. They have to adjust. Now, this whole series, this race on Sunday, sell on Monday thing, I mean, it's very, very popular, right? I mean, that's kind of an old saying from NASCAR, I guess, you know, because the stock car thing.
Yeah.
And that, you know, dramatically that's changed over the years.
Absolutely.
I mean, there's no way you can go in and buy what, you know, you see on the NASCAR track. You can buy something that looks similar to the body style you see on the NASCAR track, but it's not the same as what it used to be.
Yeah, the old days have gone.
That's right. Sound like old guys when we talk about this.
We do.
Now, fans, broadcasters, they started to call this the Great Race because a term that started, you know, becoming associated with this race about the 1960s, I guess mid-1960s, it was thought of as kind of like the pinnacle of all of Australian motorsport at the time because, you know, manufacturers were operating in this Australian market. And, you know, if they had a win in at the Bathurst track, it was just a huge boon for their industry, for their brand.
It was like their Nürburgring.
Yeah, you're right. It kind of was. It's like, you're right. It's a good way to compare it. We talk about the Nürburgring with just one lap though, you know, like
right.
One lap, fastest lap.
Yeah.
This is a whole race. You got to win an endurance race in order to claim that, that victory, I guess, for the year to say, yeah, we've got the fastest, the most reliable, the best overall package vehicle that you can get.
So this is just a piece of context to show you guys how much street cred this carried. If one of your vehicles won the Bathurst, then it became like known as the Bathurst Specials. Like that's what inspired the Australian muscle cars, called those. And these would be things like the Falcon GT, the GTHO, the Monaro, the Tirana. I can keep naming them.
That's all right. You don't have to because
the Pacer, the Charger.
Yeah, but not the AMC Pacer because a lot of people are going to think the AMC
Chrysler.
Pacer. Yeah, the Chrysler Pacer, which is dramatically different. But anyways, the idea is there is that, you know, at this track, there's no substitute for cubic inches. These were big, powerful V8 engines that were racing this, in the series all along up until a certain point. And then, you know, we'll talk about that in a minute. There comes a time when, there's a V6 guy that steps up that, kind of raises some eyebrows, but so now we're in the mid-1960s, I guess, you know, 1966 and 1967, and a tobacco company takes over sponsorship of the race, and the race becomes the Gallagher 500.
And that is short-lived. It keeps the 500, but in 1968, just a little bit later, a brake parts manufacturer takes over. So the race is renamed the Hardy Ferrodo or HF 500.
Mm-hmm. So it's still a 500-mile race at this point. And in 1969, this is the debut of one of probably the most famous characters ever to race here at the Bathurst 1000. You know, I keep saying it, the Bathurst track, I guess, maybe.
Right, yeah.
This is when Peter Brock first appears in 1969. So he did not win his first time out, as a lot of people might think he did. He is a significant player in the Bathurst history.
Yeah, Peter, King of the Mountain, Brock. Yeah. And remember, they call the circuit the mountain. He was a driver for the Holden dealer team, and this had been, you know, this is in the midst of the bloody battle between Ford and Holden, right? And I don't think it's too dramatic to say that.
No, I don't think it is.
Yeah. They had formed the Holden team earlier in the year to start fighting the factory Ford special vehicles division that was turning out the GTHO Falcons. And then they had a couple of really interesting characters that were also on the team, like Harry Firth, head of the team, who was also known as the Old Fox, which I guess means he's clever.
Maybe.
Who knows?
I don't know.
Maybe he looked like an old fox.
You know, his name's going to come up later and something that I want to mention. So, you know, keep Harry Firth in your name.
Just putting him on the radar.
Yeah. Keep him in your back pocket there for a while because, all right, this is something I think we need to get to because, you know, he didn't win initially in 1969.
Brock
did not. Yeah, but it wasn't until 1972 that he got his first win, and this is the first of 9 Bathurst wins for him. A feat that hasn't been topped yet to date.
Right. Yeah.
Some people are getting close. There's some contenders for the Brock title.
Some closer, but none better yet.
Yeah, I guess so. And, you know, we can talk about Peter Brock, a little bit more in depth right now, but we also should get to, the trophy itself, because the trophy for the whole event has been renamed the Peter Brock Trophy. And there's a reason for that, and we'll get to it, I promise. But,
let's keep walking through the time first, though.
Yeah, I think we should. So this is 1972. This is his first win of nine at the Bathurst 1000 race. And get this, Ben, this is where the dramatic shift. His first win came in a six-cylinder car, which was another first for the Bathurst race. He did it driving an upgraded LJ model Toronto GTR XU1, a car that I have never heard of until I started reading about this race. So he disproved the old adage that we had just mentioned, you know, that there's no substitute for cubic inches at the mountain.
Right.
By winning in the six-cylinder car. And it was quite a feat, because a six-cylinder car wouldn't win again at Bathurst until 1991, and that was when the Nissan Skyline GTR, the Godzilla car, won in its first time out, which was an amazing feat by all means. But that goes all the way back to 1972. So between 72 and 1991, this is the only V6 car to ever win at Bathurst.
Well, in the 72 year it's very important, because one of the first questions you would ask yourself is, why the heck would you put a V6 in a V8 competition? And it turns out there was some outside political pressure on this, what would later be known as the supercar scare.
Oh, this is good. Okay. Yeah. So I'm going to tell you right now, this is a slightly lengthy sidebar, Ben, but it's called the 1972 supercar scare. Now, how could you not read that headline and decide to kind of veer off, right?
Right.
So here's what happened. All right. I guess it's a national controversy in Australia. I mean, it arose in 1972 in regard to the sale to the public of what they called high-performance race homologation vehicles of Australian-built passenger cars. And we've talked about those cars before, right?
Right. We've talked about those cars. We've also talked about homologation, which is a loophole often. And the idea is that if you have a race that requires production cars, then manufacturers or car makers will create the minimum amount of those cars needed for them to count as production cars.
Exactly right. So I think the cutoff here was something like 200 units.
Okay.
At this point. So here's what happened. The controversy arose when an article was published by the Sydney-based Sun Herald newspaper on I think it was June 25th of 1972. So this is prior to the event that's going to happen in October that year, right? And it was written by a guy who is a motoring journalist and commentator and a successful race car rally driver named Evan Green. So this guy's a driver himself. He's been around the sport. You know, he knows the ins and outs of racing, right? And the article is titled, 160 Mile Per Hour Supercars Soon. And that's it. Okay? So he's saying that soon these manufacturers, you know, Holden and Ford and Chrysler, are going to build cars that will be capable of speeds up to 160 miles per hour. Well, this terrified a lot of people, and it's crazy. Now, the claim was that, you know, these three manufacturers are going to build these cars, and even though they know that a lot of the road, you know, the Australian roads at the time, a lot of them did not have posted speed limits.
Right.
And other roads did have posted speed limits, and I think that some of the maximum limit on city roads, or, you know, the roads that lead into cities maybe, was something around 110 kilometers per hour, like 68 miles per hour. All right. So, you know, it's not like 90 or 100 or unlimited everywhere. It's just in certain places it's unlimited.
Sure. Okay?
All right. So the intent was to make these 200 units that you mentioned, and make them able to be eligible for the, what do you call that? The Hardy Ferrodo 500? Ooh. Is that what we're calling it?
Yeah, the HF.
The HF 500. And so, you know, of course, this is a big, big event for them. So, you know, the manufacturers are saying, of course, we're going to be doing this, right? The cars, the models that were supposed to be coming out were a 320 horsepower, 5-liter V8 engine version of the Holden LJ Tirana GTR XU1, as I just mentioned, the car I'd never heard of.
Right.
A 400 horsepower version of the Ford Falcon GT HO, which was like this phase 4 version of this thing, and an uprated version of the Chrysler Valiant Charger, which was fitted with a 300 horsepower 6-cylinder engine. So these are strong cars, right? And the government's reaction was that the New South Wales Transport Minister, his name was Milton Morris, he said that he was appalled that these cars were going to be sold to ordinary motorists, and if manufacturers are making these supercars available to the general public, because it's a condition for eligibility, you know, for the Bathurst 500,
mm-hmm.
then I think it's imperative that race organizers closely examine their rules. So he's saying, we're going to put a lot of pressure on you if you go through with this.
Which is a little bit condescending if you are a quote-unquote ordinary motorist.
Yeah, definitely. I think so. I mean, you know, to look back now and say, like, well, they're...
160, really?
I guess. I mean, it seems a little strange, but I guess they think that everybody's going to go 160 in these cars everywhere, you know, at all times.
In their house, from the bathroom to the living room.
All right, so And the funny thing is that, you know, the counter agreement from the manufacturers was that these would be the best handling, safest cars on the road.
Right.
And, you know, Peter Brock himself did, however, admit to a couple of things. He said during testing, because he was involved in the testing of the holding car, he said the car was much faster on the straights, but it handled very poorly. This is also kind of cool, just a cool side note on this. He said it had so much torque that on full acceleration, it broke the windshield. That's a strong car.
Yeah. So this stuff, eventually, the pressure accumulates and a couple things happen. Holden decides to postpone the introduction of its new V8 Tirana. Originally, they said we'll postpone it for 2 years. Ford decides to abandon the Phase 4 GT, which was, as you said, based on the XA Falcon. And Chrysler also jumped in and said, you know what? We're just not going to do that charger.
Mm-hmm.
We're not going to do it.
Yeah, they came out with a detuned version of the same engine, I believe, in something else or something like that.
Which, again, they were about to up-tune.
So, yeah, the national ban on these cars was set, you know, and all the cars were kind of shelved, I guess, is what you could say. And the cars were to remain under 130 miles per hour maximum. That was kind of the end result of this whole thing.
So then here is our man, King of the Mountain, also known as Peter Perfect Brock, is racing in an XU1. And the race really comes down to between him and a guy named Alan Moffat. And Alan Moffat is driving one of those Phase 3 V8s.
Mm-hmm.
But lo and behold, the V6 beats the V8. From what I've been reading, it was primarily Brock's handling of the XU.
Yeah, he was an excellent driver.
Yeah.
I mean, he's very, very skilled. And, you know, that shows all the way through his whole career. I mean, you'll find out that he's a very talented driver. So I think that even though he had some people might say a lesser machine. I don't know. Maybe just a little less powerful, but he was able to come up with a win in 1972. And it was a strange year all around. I mean, everything was really weird.
Yeah.
Now, of course, the race went off, you know, as scheduled, just as we mentioned, under the standard series production rules for that year. The next year, they did change the rules. They switched over to Group C touring car rules, which would be used until about 1984.
In 73 is also the year that they took it from 500 miles to 1,000 kilometers.
Yeah, this is strange.
So from really 800 kilometers to 1,000.
Yeah, they went from 800 kilometers to 1,000 kilometers, but it's strange that they even changed the name of the whole thing. I mean, so it's a 500-mile race. They changed it to a 1,000-kilometer race in 1973. A little bit weird. Now, this is kind of the last little bit of this supercar scare side note that I want to mention.
Yeah.
You remember you mentioned Firth?
Uh-huh.
All right, so here's kind of the wrap-up with this whole thing. Evan Green, the guy that wrote that original article, you know, the one that that started this whole thing, the 160-mile-per-hour supercars coming soon, he went on to, you know, continue to be a television motorsport commentator for Channel 7 in Sydney, who were the broadcasters of the Bathurst 1000.
Hmm.
All right. So he's, you know, there trying to cover the event, right? Well, you can imagine that he wasn't all that popular in the pits. You know, and he had to tour around and,
right.
You know, let's say he's doing post-race interviews or pit interviews maybe during the event.
Yeah.
Well, for many, many years, he was shunned or given very short answers by Holden dealer team boss Harry Firth. And factory Ford driver Alan Moffat because, you know, he was involved in the development of the Ford vehicle too.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was like
Firth was, you mean?
Firth was for the Holden team.
Yeah, and, but Firth also worked in the past for Ford.
Oh, no kidding. Okay. I didn't know that. All right. So, you know, he's part of the Holden dealer team at this point.
Right.
So I didn't know he was a Ford guy, but anyways, the two of them really just, kind of shut down Evan Green in the pits, you know, from that point on for many, many years after that.
Cold shoulder.
Yeah, you know, it would be kind of funny to see or hear those interviews knowing the past that they had.
The shun.
Yeah, kind of interesting. The shutdown, I guess.
Yeah, you know what? It would be interesting, and I completely agree with him. I mean, as a journalist, he's just doing his job, but that if I were Firth or if I were Moffat, I wouldn't want to talk to the guy either.
Probably not.
What are you going to ruin next?
Yeah, that's
my
right.
My birthday?
This is a big deal. I mean, and I'm sure that the manufacturers were pretty upset by it. I mean, because, you know, this is a big chance for them, and it never really came back, you know?
Yeah, that's true. But the if we go up to the chronology, let's see, we've got the Group C era, and then they walk from – they do Group C till how long, Scott? Till about 84?
Yeah, I think it was about 84 because that's when we just mentioned that the Group C rules were in effect until. So
right.
I believe that's the, you know, the chronology of the whole thing.
So then after that, it goes from 85 to 92. They go to Group A touring car world rules, and this means that imported turbocharged cars like the Ford Sierra, Nissan Skyline, which you mentioned earlier, Scott, are dominating the race. But the Holden Commodore, hometown hero Holden Commodore, managed to claim three wins during this period. So what we see here is not one race that has just remained unchanged, but this race that has evolved dramatically from its original point on Phillips Island, right?
Sure.
And now it's still going on today. Very soon, but that's not all we have to tell you, because Scott, you mentioned there are several other events going on, several other races, series.
Yeah, well, there's a lot that's happened at the track in its history. So from 1938 all the way through present day, and I'm going to get back to the sponsorship and, you know, some more, I guess, timeline of the event itself.
Great.
But I want to tell you that, you know, it's the Mount Panorama Circuit has hosted a lot of different types of motorsport. They've hosted the world, of course, you know, right now, the world famous super cheap auto Bathurst 1000 that, you know, is going to happen even this year. It's going to happen in 2 days from now after we publish this podcast.
Mm-hmm.
Also there's a 12 hour GT race, another endurance race, a 24 hour endurance race that's held there. There's also the Australian Touring Car Championship that's been held there. The Australian Motorcycle Grand Prix has been held there.
Mm-hmm.
The Australian Drivers Championship is held there. And the Australian Grand Prix itself has happened there as well.
Oh.
This is kind of interesting. It hasn't happened every year, and it hasn't happened for a long time. There's really only 4 years that it was run there.
Scott, I owe you an apology. Listeners, I owe you all an apology because I just remembered something so interesting. We have to go back.
Oh, let's do it.
Okay, we talked about those Skyline victories, right?
Yes.
And they had a run of victories. In 1992, there was actually a very controversial victory. I saw in my notes and I forgot to mention.
No, what is it?
Well, okay, so not everybody is a fan of the Skyline, right?
Mm-hmm.
In Bathurst, and they wanted it, you know, to be more of a contest between the V8 cars, really between Holden and Ford.
Yeah.
That's the Cold War going on here.
And we'll see that in the future. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
We will see that in the future too. So here's what happens. The Skyline got victory after the race was stopped following this huge rainstorm that caused a number of crashes, including that of the winning car. In this event, you know, if a red flag happens, results are declared at the last completed lap. So the guy who was driving the Skyline at the time, or the team, Jim Richards and Mark Scaife, Richards was leading the race in that lap, and his team was declared the winner.
Hmm.
While the race fans didn't like this, and they were booing it, with now Noel, we're a family show, so you may have to beat me on this one, but they said they went to the winner's podium, Richards and Scaife, and people were saying things like, "This is bloody disgraceful, and you're a pack of holes."
You can say bloody.
I'm more worried about the second part.
just kidding. I'm just kidding. All right. So, you know, I've heard that name, Mark Scaife, many times, and I'll tell you, he's closing in on Peter Brock's title. He's won six times. His first win was in 1991, and then, as you mentioned, in 1992 in the same car. And then he goes on to several other victories in the 2000s in a Holden Commodore. So he's a name that you'll hear often associated with Bathurst.
Oh, and for the record, those quotes I'm pulling about disgraceful and who's a pack of what, those came from Jim Richards.
Now, how would you like to win a race and have that be your response from the crowd? That would be awful.
I mean, it's demoralizing, but you still won.
Yeah, I guess. There's controversy throughout this whole event. I mean, you know, through the history of the event. So, you know, we'll talk about some more controversy as time goes on here. But let's get back to the sponsorship of the thing.
Yeah.
And I'll just kind of quickly go through a few of these. And if there's anything of interest or of note that we should mention here, we will.
Okay.
Now, All right. So in 1981, it was called the James Hardy 1000.
Mm-hmm.
So it changed again. In 1988, the TUI's 1000. All these sponsorships just continue to change. I got to make a note about the 1994 race here. The 2 liter Super Touring Car Championship had split off from the Australian Touring Car Championship, the ATCC.
Right.
And these cars ran at Bathurst that year alongside the V8 cars with the top, they placed, I think the first place touring car vehicle was something like 10th place outright, for the Works BMW car. So not that bad. They did okay, I guess, but the V8 cars were clearly superior in that case, right?
Yeah, and there were some growing concerns about that.
Yeah, I guess so. So in 1995, because the speed difference between the V8s and the two liter touring cars, you know, the BMWs that I just mentioned and the other
right.
vehicles that were in that series, the Bathurst 1000 became a one class race for the first time in its history. And in that 1995 race, just 32 Ford and Holden V8s started the race, which was the smallest grid in the entire history of the race. And that format continued through 1996 as well, and
mm-hmm.
that's when they changed to the, is it AMP or is it AMP Bathurst 1000? I think it's just, I'm going to say AMP.
Yeah, I was going to say AMP as well.
And sponsorship remained, you know, through AMP, the Bathurst 1000,
uh-huh.
through, I believe, 1998, because then it changed to the FAI 1000 in 1999.
Mm-hmm.
Can I make just another quick observation about 97? Because this is a big deal, I think.
Is it Primus?
It is the Primus. Now, this is a strange little quirk in the history of the race. An organizational split happens in 1997 that creates this extra race, I guess, this 1997 Primus 1000 Classic that was run in 1997.
Yeah, 2 weeks after the regular race.
And this would be considered the inaugural season of the V8 Supercar Series. So, you know, fans of the V8 Supercar Series, you'll know that 97 was a big year for you, right? Now, the V8 Supercar Series was a touring car racing category that was based out of Australia, and the vehicles used in the series are loosely based on road-going four-door saloon or sedan cars again. All cars had to use a 5-liter naturally aspirated V8 engine. And I think that originally, as we mentioned, Ben, this kind of battle, this one-on-one competition really on the track.
Yeah.
Between Ford, the Ford Falcons and the Holden Commodores, they were the only ones that could compete in 1997 because of these rules.
Right. Yeah.
And as of, you know, 2013, there's a new generation V8 supercar regulation that has kind of opened the door to other manufacturers. And I know we've mentioned this on our podcast before, but 2013 marked the beginning of like new competition for Ford and Holden in this series, because Nissan, Mercedes-Benz, and
mm-hmm.
Volvo
mm-hmm.
entered the competition for the first time in 15 years. So kind of exciting, you know, that they've got something to go up against, you know, because before it was just this, you know, the two manufacturers kind of duking it out.
Yeah, and also in 2013, Ford won the first time since, what, 08?
I think, yeah, something like that. So it was a big deal. Now, you know, the series is a very popular series. All the events take place in Australian states and territories.
Mm-hmm.
And the series is broadcast in 137 countries. So it's big-time television audience for this thing. It has an average event attendance. So this is at the track. The average attendance is over 100,000 people. And some of these big events, like, you know, I would assume Bathurst, but maybe not. There's other events that are major as well in the series. Some of these get 250,000 people in the stands.
I want to take a moment and talk about safety in this race, and not as a morbid thing. But we all know, of course, racing is incredibly dangerous. It's the reason most drivers can't do it. But the Bathurst 1000 has an amazing safety record. In 50 years of racing, only 3 fatalities.
That's actually really not that bad at all. I mean,
because
no,
it's impressive, if anything.
A high speed track.
Yeah, especially, I'm telling you guys, check out the corners, check out the first and the last turn.
You know, and the thing is, Ben, I mean, I was looking up the speeds. You know, the top speed is like 186.4 miles per hour. That's 300 kilometers per
hour.
That's
on a Conrad, right?
Oh, yeah, it is. That's the longest straight, but you got to remember is that uphill? Also, I think it is.
It's gentle uphill slope.
Gentle. I don't know. You know what? While we're talking about this, I'm not gonna let this go because it's not a gentle uphill, I believe, because they do call it the mountain.
Yeah.
And now there's a 570 foot vertical difference between the highest and lowest points on the track. So this track is not flat by any means.
No,
I mean,
not
it's,
at all.
It's definitely got some up and downhill, you know, situations happening somewhere on the track. But yeah, Ben, I mean, three deaths in a long, long history. I mean, I know three is too many by any means.
Absolutely.
But still, that's really a pretty good record for a big fast track like this.
Well, only two of those were, perhaps, I guess, car accidents. It's interesting. Just real quick to walk through these.
Okay.
In 1986, a privateer entrant named Mike Bergman became the first fatality in the history of the race when his Holden Commodore struck a tire barrier at the base of the Bridgestone Bridge. This was at that time called the John Player Special, and he was on the Conrod Straight. So when they built the Chase, which is, you know, those the other three turns mm-hmm. in 87, it was dedicated to Bergman with a plaque embedded in the barriers. Mm-hmm. In 92, Formula One champion Denny Hulme, after he complains of blurred vision, he suffers a heart attack while he's driving. That's what the doctors decided. So I don't know if you can attribute that to the race.
That's
you know what I mean?
That's a tricky one.
So he unfortunately was, he was alive at the track where, you know, he had a heart attack and then this caused, you know, lost control of the vehicle. Again, on the Conrod Straight, and he was taken to the hospital where he passed away. In 1994, a private entrant from Melbourne, Don Watson, died, but he died during practice. His car left the circuit and hit a barrier again on the Conrod Straight.
So this has been, I guess it's been 20 years since there's been a fatality at the track in this event. Is that right? Since 1994, right?
Well, in 2006, there was a driver named Mark Porter who was in a Fujitsu V8 Supercar Series support race on the Friday of the meeting. He had been scheduled to compete in the 1000, but he did not.
Okay. So yeah, I guess another asterisk on that one, right?
I mean, there are asterisks here.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well,
still, that's so safe for five decades, more than that.
That really is. I mean, that's a pretty darn good record for a big fast track like this. All right. So I think, the last thing that I wanted to mention here about this split in 1997 is that, you know, it created this Primus 1000 Classic, which, you know, was this big endurance race with V8 supercars. And this is what we see today, really. I mean, it's the birth of this, right? This original, you know, 1000 Classic race was created in response to the desire of the V8 supercar organizers, who was, I think it was a Vesco at the time, to compete at the popular Mount Panorama circuit outside of the traditional Bathurst 1000 event. And so this is, I guess the best way to say this, Ben, is that it came down to a television coverage dispute, between a Vesco, which was holding a series contract with Network 10, and ARDC, which was the Australian Racing Drivers Club. And they held a contract with the 7 Network, and so they just could not come to terms. They weren't able to negotiate a deal. And the solution was the Bathurst City Council negotiated a deal between Avesco and this other group for a separate race to be held 2 weeks after the 1997 AMP Bathurst 1000, which subsequently went ahead with a field of Australian and British super touring cars. Mm-hmm. So it was a completely different event held 2 weeks later. And that now is the big event.
Yeah, isn't that weird?
Yeah, kind of switched there.
Again, that's the strange thing about these sorts of negotiations and rights and arguments and stuff.
These splits, these negotiations and these deals, these all really complicate things. I mean, think back to when we talked about IndyCar and their dealings with CART and the split that happened there and then the eventual merge, I guess.
I feel like the business of racing, although I understand that it is necessary, and for many people, it's the point of having races in the first place. Mm-hmm. But I feel like the business of racing gets in the way of the race, mm-hmm. you know, too often.
It does seem that way. I agree. And so, you know, we were talking about sponsorships.
Yeah.
And after 1997, I think in 1999, it became the FAI 1000. And since 1999, this race has been run exclusively for V8 supercars and is now around the V8 Supercar Championship Series. So, you know, going back a decent amount of time, I guess at this point, what, 15 years from now?
Yeah.
It's been exclusively for V8 supercars. And then, you know, there's still more name changes for this thing. So let's just quickly go through
so we can get to the end here.
Because I'd like to talk about the trophy if we could.
Absolutely. How about this? Let's go through laundry list the end. I want to bring some, records mm-hmm. out. And maybe just laundry list some of the famous winners, and then we'll get to the trophy.
Sounds great. All right. So, you know, really, it's just four more. It became the V8 Supercar 1000 in 2001.
Mm-hmm.
In 2002, it changed over to the Bob Jane T-Martz 1000. These are unwieldy names, aren't they?
Some of them are.
Yeah. All right. And then in 2005, it was renamed the Super Cheap Auto 1000. And then from 2006 to present, just a slight change in this. It's the Super Cheap Auto Bathurst 1000.
In case you were wondering.
Yeah, it's just strange. A little change there. And, you know, Ben, can I just say one quick thing?
Yeah.
I know that I was looking up, Super Cheap, because to me, this just doesn't sound like a good name for a racing sponsorship, I guess.
Right.
Super Cheap, I mean, it has kind of a funny connotation, but it's a big deal. I mean, the company's a big deal. Over the past 15 years, Super Cheap Auto, which is an Australian-based automotive retailer, they've increased their compound annual revenue like by 25% every year. It's a huge growing industry.
They're running the game.
Yeah, really big. Their managing director is a guy named Peter Bertels, and I believe that he was CEO of the year last year. He's a big deal. So it's a big popular company, but to me, I mean, just when I hear the word Super Cheap Auto, I mean, it doesn't really, you know, spell out quality to me.
No, no
maybe
kidding.
I shouldn't say that.
Why is that?
I don't know. Just super cheap.
I'm being sarcastic.
Maybe super inexpensive.
Yeah. Hey, did you know though that they are an auto industry company when you first saw the name Super Cheap?
Yeah. I had the feeling that they were, because going back through the history, you know, all these have some type of relationship to the auto industry.
Right.
You know, they provide something. But this is maybe one of the ones that's a little less obvious.
Well, buddy, don't be too distressed, because if history of the Bathurst 1000 has taught us anything, it's that the name is going to change.
It's true. That's true.
So let's walk through some of the other famous winners here, famous drivers. I think it's important for us to note Bob Jane. As you said, he had the race named after him for a time. He won the race four times from 61 to 64, and this led to him creating his fame from that, led him to creating his own automotive businesses, dealerships, tire retailers. Jim Richards, who we mentioned before also, is a close competitor for the rank of the most wins, because he won the race seven times, and he has the record for the most starts at the event. And then there's Larry Perkins, third most successful driver. He has six victories. And interestingly enough, Richards and Perkins shared some of their victories as co-drivers. But, of course, I say all this to lead us into what?
As co-drivers with Brock, right?
Yes.
Yeah, that's right.
Lead us into.
You left out the Brock name in that
right.
one.
I left it out because there's one guy who's so famous that they changed the trophy for him.
I know. It's incredible, isn't it? I mean, this Peter Brock guy. All right. So let's explain who Peter Brock is, first of all. Peter Brock was what they call Peter Perfect, or they call him the King of the Mountain, or Brocky sometimes, I think, are his nicknames. Now, this is, I guess I have to distinguish this, Ben. He's not the Peter Brock photojournalist. An automotive designer from the United States, because here in the U.S., there's a guy that, you know what? We'll talk about Peter Brock in another episode. How about
yeah,
that?
Yeah,
but
yeah.
It's not that guy. This is a different guy. This is one of Australia's best known and most successful motor racing drivers of all time.
Yeah, it's like the Dale Earnhardt of Australia.
Yeah, he kind of is.
They would call Dale Earnhardt the Peter Brock of the U.S.
You're probably right. That would be the way it would be. So he's most often associated with Holden, because he drove for them for, I think, 40 years or something like that. The Holden dealer team produced Brock's race cars for, you know, that entire history of him racing at the Bathurst. However, I do want to point out that he did race other vehicles from other manufacturers throughout that time as well. He raced for BMW, for Porsche, Ford, Peugeot, Volvo. You know, there were other manufacturers along the way. He won the Bathurst 1000, as we mentioned, nine times. His first win came on his fourth attempt at the race in 1972. And his final win was in 1987. So he did all of that In that 15-year time span there.
And he also did two hat tricks, which would be three consecutive wins. So he won three times in a row twice.
That's pretty incredible, really. I mean, when you think about it, amazing. I want to say something, though, quickly about his 1987 win that we just mentioned. Yeah. That was actually awarded in January of 1988, you know, so long, long after the race is over, because the two Ford cars that had won the race, you know, the position one and two, were disqualified after they found that they had illegal wheel arches. Now, can you imagine that? I mean, to have the victory of the Bathurst 1000 taken away from you for illegal wheel arches.
Ouch.
It's maddening, isn't
it? But I'm sure way worse than a crowd booing you for winning.
But I'm sure Brock was happy. Now, he was in, actually, he placed third in the race itself. I mean, he drove across the line third. And I believe that was something else, because I think he was in a backup car that he had you know, crashed out or something in his own car, went to a backup car, and then placed third in that car. And then the first two cars were disqualified. So it's this, you know, this complex series of events that led to his ninth victory, but he got it. And, you know, a win's a win, right?
Right.
So he also won the Sandown 500 touring car race nine times, which is a big deal, because that's the Sandown 500 is the traditional lead-up race to the Bathurst race. So, you know, he's got all this this momentum going, I guess, for the Bathurst event. He also won the Australian Touring Car Championship three times. And he also won the Bathurst 24-hour race just one time, but he did win, and that's important. So, you know, it's a big deal. He's inducted into the V8 Supercar Hall of Fame in 2001.
Uh-huh.
And unfortunately, Ben, he passed away in 2006, on September 8th in 2006. He's only 61 years old when he died.
It was an accident during a rally, the Targa West event.
Exactly right. And that was near, it was in Perth. Which is in Western Australia, right?
Also sometimes called the most isolated city in the world.
I could understand why. I've seen photos from this event. They're way out there. And he skidded off the road, I guess, hit a tree in his 2001 Daytona sports car. And this is where maybe the other Peter Brock comes into play here, because this is kind of an unusual twist to this whole thing. Now, he skidded off the road, you know, high speed, and crashed this 2001 Daytona sports car. And the Daytona sports car is an Australian-built reproduction of the Shelby Daytona Coupe from 1964, you know, the U.S. car, an American car. And coincidentally, that car, you know, the original Shelby Daytona car from 1964 was designed by the other Peter Brock.
How about that?
How weird is that, huh?
That is weird.
I know, it's pretty strange. So this guy was such a national hero, a pillar of the racing community, that they decided that in 2006... they were going to honor his name by, changing the name of the trophy, the trophy that's given out at the end of the Bathurst 1000, to be called the Peter Brock Trophy.
Mm-hmm. And that 2006 race also had various special tributes to Brock, as well as a champion's lap of honor featuring his past co-drivers parading cars that Brock had won the race in. So
that's a nice tribute.
Yeah, I think that's a really nice one. And the trophy now reads King of the Mountain, nickname of Brock's. The trophy weighs about 6 pounds, and it's 20 inches tall, just in case you haven't seen it before. And there, ladies and gentlemen, is the background to the Bathurst 1000.
Yeah.
Now, if you are one of the lucky, well, I can't say lucky few, because there are tens of thousands of people that are going to check it out. If you were one of the people who were lucky enough to get there, though, we would love to hear from you. We hope that you enjoyed the history of this. And I know we went a little bit long on this one, but there was a lot of stuff to talk about, and there might even be one more thing.
Yeah, maybe. You know, can I have one more thing?
Yeah, oh, please, yeah.
All right, my own one more thing.
No, it's your one more thing. I'm talking about your thing.
This is it, then.
One more thing.
All right, I just wanted to mention that this 2014 event, the one that is coming up right now this year, you better get to it right away if you can, because it's happening just days after this podcast airs initially. So the 2014 event is held on the second Sunday of October, which is October 9th through 12th, 2014. So if you can get there by all means, because it's quite an event. I've been watching video from this race for the last few days, Ben, just checking, some of the amazing last laps type things, and stuff that we like to watch in lead up to a podcast like this, to kind of get in the mood of, the feel for the place, right? The event. And it's so fast. It's so exciting. It's so, the announcers add a lot to it because they're excited. And it's a great event. It's fun to watch. And if you can make it to this thing, you know, October 9th through the 12th, I say by all means go.
But we want to make a deal with you. Only go if you promise to write to us about it later.
Maybe take a photo or two.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you, Scott. Now listen, Australia. I mean, I don't know why I'm addressing the entire country, but just in case, yeah, we really would legitimately, sincerely love to hear about this because we have not had a chance to travel down there yet. If you would like to check out some more of our episodes about races, visit carstuffshow.com where you can check out every podcast we have ever made. And oh, buddy, there are quite a few.
Yes, there are. We got to be getting into the, 610 range, something like that.
Yeah, I'm just going to forget about the number until we hit 1,000.
Yeah, I think I will too.
So you can also find us on Facebook and Twitter where we are Carstuff HSW. And if you want to take a page from our excellent listener, Aaron, who suggested this episode, you can write to us directly. We are
carstuff@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@howstuffworks.com.